He still had a full magazine of 20mm cannon shells, but suddenly all the G's and all the excitement were pulling on him. His arms felt leaden as he eased his Eagle back to level flight. Bore lead, Eagle. Looks like we're okay now, but that was kinda exciting, fella.
Roger that, Eagle. Same here. Anything left?
Negative, Bohr. Rodeo lead got the last two. I think we owe that major a couple of beers.
I'll hold you to that, Eagle, rodeo lead observed.
Ducky, where are you? Winters called next.
Kinda busy, Bronco, a strained voice replied. I got a hole in my arm, too.
Bronco, Ghostman, Ducky's got some holes in the airframe. I'm going to shepherd him back to Suntar. 30 minutes, about.
Skippy, where you be?
Right behind you, leader. I think I got 4, maybe 5 in that furball.
Any weapons left?
Slammer and winder, 1 each.
I'll look after you, Colonel, Lieutenant Acosta promised.
How'd you make out?
2, maybe more, not sure, the squadron commander answered.
The final tally would come from the AWACS, plus a check of his own videotape. Mainly, he wanted to get out of the aircraft and take a good stretch. And he now had time to worry about Major Don Boyd, Ducky, and his aircraft.
So, we want to mess with their heads, Mickey? Admiral Dave Seaton asked.
That's the idea, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs told the chief of naval operations.
Makes sense. Where are their heads at?
According to what CIA says, they think we're limiting the scope of operations for political reasons. To protect their sensibilities, like.
No fooling?
Seaton asked with no small degree of incredulity.
Moore nodded.
Yep.
Well, then it's like a guy holding aces and eights, isn't it?
The CNO thought aloud, referring to the last poker hand held by James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, in Deadwood, South Dakota.
We just picked a mission that's sure to flip them out.
What are you thinking? Moore asked.
We can slam their navy pretty hard. Bart Mancuso's a pretty good operator.
What are they most afraid of?
Seaton leaned back in his swivel chair.
First thing Bart wants to do is take out their missile submarine. It's at sea now with Tucson in trail. About 20,000 yards back.
That far?
It's plenty close enough. It's got an SSN in close proximity to protect it. So Tucson takes them both out. Zap.
Moore didn't get the terminology, but Seaton was referring to the Chinese ships as it, meaning an enemy, a target worthy only of destruction.
Beijing might not know it's happened right away unless they've got an I'm dead boy on the sail. Their surface navy's a lot easier. That'll be mainly aircraft targets, some missiles to keep the surface community happy.
Submarine-launched missiles?
Mickey, you don't sink ships by making holes that let air in. You sink ships by making holes that let water in, Seaton explained.
Okay, if this is supposed to be for psychological effect, we hit everything simultaneously.
That'll mean staging a lot of assets, and it runs the risk of being overly complicated, having the other guy catch a sniff of what's happening before we do anything. It's a risk. Do we really want to run it?
Ryan's thinking big picture. Robbie's helping him.
Robbie's a fighter pilot, Seaton agreed. He likes to think in terms of movie stuff. Hell, Tom Cruise is taller than he is, Seaton joked.
Good operational thinker. He was a pretty good J-3, Moore reminded the senior sailor.
Yeah, I know. It's just that he likes to make dramatic plays.
Okay, we can do it. Only it complicates things.
Seaton looked out the window for a second.
You know what might really flip them out?
What's that? Moore asked.
Seaton told him.
But it's not possible for us to do, is it?
Maybe not, but we're not dealing with professional military people, are we? They're politicians, Mickey. They're used to dealing with images instead of reality. so we give them an image. Do you have the pieces in place to do that?
Let me find out.
This is crazy, Dave.
And deploying first armored to Russia isn't? The CNO demanded.
Lieutenant Colonel Angelo Giusti was now certain that he'd be fully content never to ride on another train as long as he lived. He didn't know that all of the Russian State Railroad sleeper cars were being used to transport Russian army forces. They'd never sent any of the cars as far west as Berlin. Not to slight the Americans, but because it had simply never occurred to anyone to do so. He took note of the fact that the train veered off to the north, off the main track, thumping over various switches and interlockings as it did so. And then the train came to a halt and started going backward slowly. They seemed to be in the yard alone. They'd passed numerous westbound trains in the past 2 hours, all with engines dragging empty flat cars. And the conductor, who appeared and disappeared regularly, had told them that this was the approximate arrival time scheduled. But he hadn't really believed it, on the premise that a railroad with such uncomfortable seats probably didn't adhere to decent schedules either. But here they were, and the offloading ramps were obvious for what they were. "People, I think we're here," the commander of the quarter horse told his staff.
"Praise Jesus," one of them observed.
A few seconds later, the train jolted to a stop, and they were able to walk out onto the concrete platform, which, they saw, stretched a good 1,000 meters to the east. Inside of 5 minutes, the soldiers of headquarters troop were out and walking to their vehicles, stretching and grousing along the way.
"Hey, Angie," called a familiar voice.
Giusti looked to see Colonel Welch and walked up to him with a salute.
"What's happening?" Giusti asked.
"It's a mess out east of here, but there is good news."
"What might that be?"
"There's plenty of fuel stashed for us. I've been flying security detachments out, and Ivan says he's got fuel depots that are the size of fucking supertankers. So we're not going to run out of gas."
"That's good to know. What about my choppers?"
Welch just pointed. There was an OH-58D Kiowa Warrior sitting not 300 yards away.
"Thank God for that. What's the bad news?"
"The PLA has 4 complete Group A armies in Siberia and heading north. There hasn't been any heavy contact yet because Ivan's refusing combat at the moment, until they can get something big enough to meet them with. They have 1 motor rifle division in theater and 4 more heading up there. The last of them just cleared this rail yard an hour and a half ago."
"That's what? 16 heavy divisions in the invasion force?"
Welch nodded.
"Thereabouts."
"What's my mission?"
"Assemble your squadron and head southeast. The idea is First Armored will cut off the bottom of the break-in and interrupt their supply line. Russian blocking force will then try to stop them about 200 miles northeast of here."
"Can they do it?"
4 Russian divisions against 16 Chinese didn't seem especially favorable odds.
"Not sure," Welch admitted.
"Your job is to get out and establish lead security for the division. Advance to and secure the first big fuel depot. We'll play it from there."
"Support?"
"At the moment, the Air Force is mainly doing fighter work. No deep strikes yet because they don't have enough bombs to sustain any kind of campaign."
"What about the resupply?"
"We have 2 basic loads for all the tracks. That'll have to do for a while. At least we have 4 units of fire for the artillery."
That meant 4 days' worth of shells, based on what the Army computed that a day of combat required. The supply weenies who did those calculations weren't stingy on shells to shoot at the other guy. And in the entire Persian Gulf War, not a single tank had completely shot out its first basic load of shells, they both knew. But that was a different war. No 2 were ever the same, and they only got worse. Giusti turned when he heard the first engine start up. It was an M3A2 Bradley Scout track, and the sergeant in the commander's hatch looked happy to be moving. A Russian officer looked over his traffic cop, waving the Brad forward, then right toward the assembly area. The next train backed up to the next ramp over. That would be A, or Avenger troop, with the first of Quarter Horse's really heavy equipment, 9 of the M1A2 main battle tanks.
"How long before everything's here?" Giusti asked.
90 minutes, they told me," Welch answered.
"We'll see."
"What's this?" a captain asked the screen in front of him. The E-3B sentry designated Eagle 2 was back on the ground at Gigansk. Its crew was more than a little shaken. Being approached by real fighters with real blood in their eyes was qualitatively different from exercises and post-mission analysis back stateside. The tapes of the engagement had been handed off to the wing intelligence staff, who viewed the battle with some detachment. But they could see that the PLAAF had thrown a full regiment of first-line fighters at the AWACS, and more than that, done it on a one-way mission. They'd come in on burner, and that would have denied them a trip back to their base. So they'd been willing to trade over 30 fighters for a single E-3B. But there was more to the mission than that, the captain saw.
"Look here," he told his colonel.
4 reconnaissance birds went northwest." He ran the tape forward and backward.
"We didn't touch any of them.
Hell, they didn't even see them."
"Well, I'm not going to fault the sentry crew for that, Captain."
"Not saying that, sir. But John Chinaman just got some pictures of Cheetah, and also of these Russian units moving north."
"The cat's out of the bag, Colonel."
"We've got to start thinking about some counter-air missions on those airfields."
"We have bombs to do it?"
"Not sure, but I'm taking this to General Wallace. What's the score on the air fight?"
"Colonel Winter's got 4 for sure and 2 probables."
"Damn, that guy's really cleaning up." "But it was the 16 guys saved the AWACS. These 2 J-8s got pretty damn close before Rodeo splashed them."
"We'll put some more coverage on the E-3s from now on," the colonel observed.
"Not a bad idea, sir."
"Yes," General Peng said, when his intelligence officer came up to him.
"Aerial reconnaissance reports large mechanized formations 150 kilometers west of us, moving north and northeast."
"Strength?" the general asked.
"Not sure. Analysis of the photos is not complete, but certainly regimental strength. Maybe more."
"Where exactly?"
"Here, Comrade General."
The intelligence officer unfolded a map and pointed. "They were spotted here, here, and from here to here. The pilot said large numbers of tanks and tracked vehicles."
"Did they shoot at him?"
"No, he said there was no fire at all."
"So they are rushing to where they are going. Racing to get to our flank, or to get ahead of us?"
Peng considered this, looking down at the map.
"Yes, that's what I would expect.
Any reports from our front?"
"Comrade General, our reconnaissance screen reports that they have seen the tracks of vehicles, but no visual sightings of the enemy at all. They have taken no fire and seen nothing but civilians."
"Quickly," Alexandrov urged.
How the driver and his assistant had gotten the Zeal 157 to this place was a mystery whose solution didn't interest the captain. That it had gotten here was enough. His lead BRM at that moment had been Sergeant Gretschko's, and he'd filled up his tanks, and then radioed to the rest of the company, which for the first time broke visual contact with the advancing Chinese and raced north to top off as well. It was dangerous and against doctrine to leave the Chinese unseen, but Alexandrov couldn't guarantee that they'd all have a chance to refuel otherwise. Then Sergeant Buikov had a question.
"When do they refuel, Comrade Captain? We haven't seen them do it, have we?"
That made his captain stop and think.
"Why, no, we haven't. Their tanks must be as empty as ours."
"They had extra fuel drums the first day, remember? They dropped them off sometime yesterday."
"Yes, so maybe they have one more day of fuel, maybe only half a day. But then someone must refill them."
But who will that be, and how? The officer wondered. He turned to look. The fuel came out of the portable pump at about 40 liters or 10 gallons per minute. Gretschko had taken his BRM south to re-establish contact with the Chinese. They were still sitting still, between Frog Leap bounds, probably half an hour away if they stuck with their drill, from which they hadn't once deviated. And people had once said that the Red Army was inflexible. "There, that's it," Alexandrov's driver said. He handed the hose back and capped the tank. "You," the captain told the driver of the fuel truck, "go east." "To where?" the man asked. "There's nothing there." That stopped his thinking for a few seconds. There had been a sawmill here once, and you could see the wide swaths of saplings left over from when whoever had worked here had cut trees for lumber. It was the closest thing to open ground they'd seen in over a day. "I came from the west. I can get back there now with the truck lighter, and it's only 6 kilometers to the old logging road." "Very well, but do it quickly, Corporal. If they see you, they'll blast you." "Farewell then, Comrade Captain." The corporal got back into the truck, started up, and turned to the north to loop around. "I hope someone gives him a drink tonight. He's earned it," Buikov said. There was much more to any army than the shooters. "Gretschko, where are you?" Alexandrov called over his radio. 4 kilometers south of you. They're still dismounted, Captain. Their officer seems to be talking on the radio." "Very well. You know what to do when they remount." The captain set the radio microphone down and leaned against his track. This business was getting very old. Buikov lit a smoke and stretched. "Why can't we just kill a few of them, Comrade Captain? Would it not be worth it to get some sleep?" "How many times must I tell you what our fucking mission is, Sergeant?" Alexandrov nearly screamed at his sergeant. "Yes, Captain," Buikov responded meekly. Chapter 56. March to Danger. Lieutenant Colonel Giusti started off in his personal Humvee, the new incarnation of the venerable Jeep. Using a Bradley would have been more comfortable, even more sensible, but overly dramatic, he thought, and there wouldn't be any contact any time soon. Besides, the right front seat in this vehicle was better for his back after the endless train ride. In any case, he was following a Russian UAZ-469, which looked like a Russian interpretation of an American SUV, and whose driver knew the way. The Kiowa Warrior helicopter he'd seen at the rail yard was up and flying, scouting ahead and reporting back that there was nothing there but mostly empty road, except for some civilian traffic being kept out of the way by Russian MPs. Right behind Giusti's command vehicle was a Bradley flying the red and white guidon of the 1st of the 4th Cavalry. The regiment had, for American arms, a long and distinguished history. Its combat action had begun on July 30, 1857, against the Cheyenne Indians at Solomon River, and this campaign would add yet another battle streamer to the regimental standard, and Giusti hoped he'd live long enough to attach it himself. The land here reminded him of Montana, rolling foothills with pine trees in abundance. The views were decently long, just what a mechanized trooper liked, because it meant you could engage an enemy at long range. American soldiers especially preferred that, because they had weapons that could reach farther than those of most other armies. "Dark Horse 6 to Sabre 6, over," the radio crackled. "Sabre 6. Lieutenant Colonel Giusti responded. "Sabre, I'm now at Checkpoint Denver. The way continues to be clear. Negative traffic, negative enemy indications, over. Proceeding east to Checkpoint Wichita." "Roger that. Thank you. Out." Giusti checked the map to be sure he knew exactly where the chopper was. So, 20 miles ahead, there was still nothing to be concerned about. At least according to the captain flying his lead helicopter. Where would it start? Giusti wondered.
On the whole, he would have preferred to stand still and sit in on the divisional commander's conference, just to find out what the hell was happening. But as cavalry screen commander, it was his job to go out forward and find the enemy, then report back to Iron Six, the divisional commander. He really didn't have much of a mission yet, aside from driving up to the Russian fuel depot, refueling his vehicles there, and setting up security, then pulling out and continuing his advance as the leading elements of the 1st Armored's heavy forces got there. It was his job, in short, to be the ham in the sandwich, as one of his troop commanders liked to joke. But this ham could bite back. Under his command were 3 troops of armored cavalry, each with 9 M1A2 Abrams main battle tanks and 13 M3A2 Bradley cavalry scout vehicles, plus a fist V-track for forward observers to call in artillery support. Somewhere behind him, the 1st Armored's artillery would be offloading soon from its train, he hoped. His most valuable assets were D and E troops, each with 8 OH-58D Kiowa Warrior helicopters, able both to scout ahead and to shoot with Hellfire and Stinger missiles. In short, his squadron could look after itself, within reasonable limits. As they got closer, his troopers would become more cautious and circumspect, because, good as they were neither invincible nor immortal. America had fought against China only once, in Korea nearly 60 years earlier, and the experience had been satisfactory to neither side. For America, the initial Chinese attack had been unexpected and massive, forcing an ignominious retreat from the Yalu River. But for China, once America had gotten its act together, the experience had cost 1 million lives, because firepower was always the answer to raw numbers. And America's lasting lesson from its own civil war was that it was better to expend things than to expend people. The American way of war was not shared by everyone, and in truth it was tailored to American material prosperity as much as to American reverence for human life. But it was the American way, and that was the way its warriors were schooled. "I think it's about time to roll them back a little," General Wallace observed over the satellite link to Washington. "What do you propose?" Mickey Moore asked. "For starters, I want to send my F-16 CGs after their radar sites. I'm tired of having them use radar to direct their fighters against my aircraft. Next, I want to start going after their logistical choke points. In 12 hours, the way things are going, I'll have enough ordnance to start doing some offensive warfare here." "And it's about time for us to start, General," Wallace said. "Gus, I have to clear that with the President," the chairman told the Air Force commander in Siberia. "Okay, fine, but tell him we damn near lost an AWACS yesterday, with a crew of 30 or so. And I'm not in a mood to write that many letters. We've been lucky so far, and an AWACS is a hard kill. Hell, it cost them a full regiment of fighters to fail in that mission. But enough's enough. I want to go after their radar sites, and I want to do some offensive counter-air." "Gus, the thinking here is that we want to commence offensive operations in a systematic way for maximum psychological effect. That means more than just knocking some antennas down." "General, I don't know what it looks like over there, but right here it's getting a little exciting. Their army is advancing rapidly. Pretty soon our Russian friends are going to have to make their stand. It'll be a whole lot easier if the enemy is short on gas and bullets." "We know that. We're trying to figure a way to shake up their political leadership." "It isn't politicians coming north trying to kill us, General. It's soldiers and airmen. We have to start crippling them before they ruin our whole damn day." "I understand that, Gus. I will present your position to the President," the chairman promised. "Do that, will you?" Wallace killed the transmission, wondering what the hell the Lotus Eaters in Washington were thinking about, assuming they were thinking at all. He had a plan, and he thought it was a pretty good systematic one. His Dark Star drones had given him all the tactical intelligence he needed. He knew what targets to hit, and he had enough ordnance to do the hitting. Or at least to start doing it. "If they let me," Wallace thought. "Well, it wasn't a complete waste," Marshal Luo said.
We got some pictures of what the Russians are doing.
And what's that? Zhang asked.
They're moving one or two, probably two, divisions northeast from their rail assembly point at Chita. We have good aerial pictures of them.
And still nothing in front of our forces?
Luo shook his head.
Our reconnaissance people haven't seen anything more than tracks in the ground. I have to assume there are Russians in those woods somewhere, doing reconnaissance of their own. But if so, they're light forces who are working very hard to keep out of the way. We know they've called up some reserves, but they haven't shown up either. Maybe their reservists didn't report. Morale in Russia is supposed to be very low, Tan tells us. And that's all we've really seen. The men we captured are very disheartened because of their lack of support. And they didn't fight all that well. Except for the American airplanes, this war is going extremely well.
And they haven't attacked our territory yet? Zhang wanted to be clear on that.
Another shake of the head.
No, and I can't claim that they're afraid to do it. Their fighter aircraft are excellent, but to the best of our knowledge, they haven't even attempted a photo reconnaissance mission. Maybe they just depend on satellites now. Certainly those are supposed to be excellent sources of information for them.
And the gold mine?
We'll be there in 36 hours. And at that point we can make use of the roads their own engineers have been building to exploit the mineral finds. From the gold mine to the oil fields, 5 to 7 days, depending on how well we can run supplies up.
This is amazing, Luo, Zhang observed. Better than my fondest hopes.
I almost wish the Russians would stand and fight somewhere, so that we could have a battle and be done with it. As it is, my forces are stringing out somewhat, but only because the lead elements are racing forward so well. I've thought about slowing them down to maintain unit integrity, but...
But speed works for us, doesn't it? Zhang observed.
Yes, it would seem to, the defense minister agreed. But one prefers to keep units tightly grouped in case there is some contact. However, if the enemy is running, one doesn't want to give him pause to regroup. So I'm giving General Peng and his divisions free rein.
What forces are you facing?
We're not sure. Perhaps a regiment or so could be ahead of us, but we see no evidence of it. And two more regiments are trying to race ahead of us, or attack our flank, but we have flank security out to the west, and they've seen nothing.
Bondarenko hoped that someday he'd meet the team that had developed this American Dark Star drone. Never in history had a commander possessed such knowledge as this, and without it, he would have been forced to commit his slender forces to battle just to ascertain what stood against him. Not now. He probably had a better feel for the location of the advancing Chinese than their own commander did. Better yet, the leading regiment of the 201st Motor Rifle Division was only a few kilometers away, and the leading formation was the division's Steel Fist, its independent tank regiment of 95 T-80U main battle tanks. The 265th was ready for the reinforcement, and its commander, Yuri Sinyavsky, proclaimed that he was tired of running away. A career professional soldier and mechanized infantryman, Sinyavsky was a profane, cigar-chomping man of 46 years, now leaning over a map table in Bondarenko's headquarters.
This is my ground, Gennady Yosifovich, he said, stabbing at the point with his finger.
It was just 5 kilometers north of the Gogol goldfield, a line of ridges 20 kilometers across, facing open ground the Chinese would have to cross.
And put the 201st's tanks just here on my right. When we stop their advance guard, they can blow in from the west and roll them up.
A reconnaissance shows their leading division is strung out somewhat, Bondarenko told him.
It was a mistake made by every army in the world. The sharpest teeth of any field force are its artillery. But even self-propelled artillery, mounted on tracks for cross-country mobility, can't seem to keep up with the mechanized forces it is supposed to support. It was a lesson that had even surprised the Americans in the Persian Gulf, when they'd found their artillery could keep up with the leading tank echelons only with strenuous effort, and across flat ground. The People's Liberation Army had tracked artillery, but a lot of it was still the towed variety, and was being pulled behind trucks that could not travel cross-country as well as the tracked kind. General Diggs observed the discussion, which his rudimentary Russian could not quite keep up with, and Sinyavsky spoke no English, which really slowed things down.
"You still have a lot of combat power to stop Yuri Andreevich," Diggs pointed out, waiting for the translation to get across.
"If we cannot stop them completely, at least we can give them a bloody nose," was the belated reply.
"Stay mobile," Diggs advised. "If I were this General Pang, I'd maneuver east. The ground is better suited for it. And try to wrap you up from your left."
"We will see how maneuver-minded they are," Bondarenko said for his subordinate. "So far, all they have done is drive straight forward, and I think they are becoming complacent. See how they are stretched out, Marion. Their units are too far separated to provide mutual support. They are in a pursuit phase of warfare, and that makes them disorganized, and they have little air support to warn them of what lies ahead. I think Yuri is right. This is a good place for a stand."
"I agree it's good ground, Gennady. Just don't marry the place, okay?" Diggs warned.
Bondarenko translated that for his subordinate, who answered back in machine gun Russian around his cigar.
"Yuri says it is a place for a fucking, not a wedding. When will you join your command, Marion?"
"My chopper's on the way in now, buddy. My cavalry screen is at the first fuel depot, with 1st Brigade right behind. We should be in contact in a day and a half or so."
They'd already discussed Diggs's plan of attack. 1st Armored would assemble northwest of Belogorsk, fueling at the last big Russian depot, then leap out in the darkness for the Chinese bridgehead. Intelligence said that the PLA's 65th Type B Group Army was there now, digging in to protect the left shoulder of their break-in. Not a mechanized force, it was still a lot for a single division to chew on. If the Chinese plan of attack had a weakness, it was that they'd bet all their mechanized forces on the drive forward. The forces left behind to secure the breakthrough were at best motorized, carried by wheeled vehicles instead of tracked ones, and at worst leg infantry, who had to walk where they went. That made them slow and vulnerable to men who sat down behind steel as they went to battle in their tracked vehicles.
But there were a hell of a lot of them, Diggs reminded himself.
Before he could leave, General Sinyavsky reached into his hip pocket and pulled out a flask.
"A drink for luck," he said in his only words of broken English.
"Hell, why not?" Diggs tossed it off. It was good stuff, actually.
"When this is all over, we will drink again," he promised.
"Da," the general replied.
"Good luck, Diggs."
"Marion," Bondarenko said, "be careful, comrade."
"You too, Gennady. You got enough medals, buddy. No sense getting your ass shot off trying to win another."
"Generals are supposed to die in bed," Bondarenko agreed on the way to the door.
Diggs trotted out to the UH-60. Colonel Boyle was flying this one. Diggs donned the crash helmet, wishing they'd come up with another name for the damn thing, and settled in the jump seat behind the pilots.
"How we doing, sir?" Boyle asked, letting the lieutenant take the chopper back off.
"Well, we have a plan, Dick. Question is, will it work?"
"Do I get let in on it?"
"Your Apaches are going to be busy."
"There's a surprise," Boyle observed.
"How are your people?"
"Ready," was the one-word reply.
"What are we calling this?"
"Chopsticks."
Diggs then heard a laugh over the intercom wire.
"I love it!"
"Okay, Mickey," Robbie Jackson said, "I understand Gus's position, but we have a big picture here to think about." They were in the Situation Room looking at the chairman on TV from the Pentagon Room, known as the Tank. It was hard to hear what he was muttering that way, but the way he looked down was a sufficient indication of his feelings about Robbie's remark.
"General," Ryan said, "the idea here is to rattle the cage of their political leadership. Best way to do that is to go after them in more places than one. Overload them."
"Sir, I agree with that idea, but General Wallace has his point, too.
Taking down their radar fence will degrade their ability to use their fighters against us. And they still have a formidable fighter force, even though we've handled them pretty rough so far.
Mickey, if you handle a girl this way down in Mississippi, it's called rape, the vice president observed. Their fighter pilots look at their aircraft now and they see caskets, for Christ's sake. Their confidence has got to be gone, and that's all a fighter jock has to hold on to. Trust me on this one, will you?
But Gus is too worried about his force.
Okay, fine, let him send some Charlie Golfs against their picket fence. But mainly we want those birds armed with smart pigs to go after their ground forces. The fighter force can look after itself.
For the first time, General Mickey Moore regretted Ryan's choice of vice president. Robbie was thinking like a politician rather than an operational commander. And that came as something of a surprise. He was seemingly less worried about the safety of his forces than of what the overall objective was, Moore corrected himself. And that was not a completely bad way to think, was it? Jackson had been a pretty good J-3 not so long before, hadn't he? American commanders no longer thought of their men as expendable assets. That was not a bad thing at all. But sometimes you had to put forces in harm's way. And when you did that, some of them did not come home. And that was what they were paid for, whether you liked it or not. Robbie Jackson had been a Navy fighter pilot, and he hadn't forgotten the warrior ethos, despite his new job and pay grade.
Sir, Moore said, what orders do I give General Wallace?
Cecil B. Goddamn DeMille, Mancuso observed crossly.
Ever wanted to part the Red Sea? General Lahr asked.
I ain't God, Mike, Sink Pack said next.
Well, it is elegant, and we do have most of the pieces in place, his J-2 pointed out.
This is a political operation. What the hell are we, a goddamned focus group?
Sir, are you going to continue to rant, or are we going to get to work on this?
Mancuso wished for a Lupara to blast a hole in the wall, or Mike Lahr's chest. But he was a uniformed officer, and he did now have orders from his commander-in-chief.
All right, I just don't like to have other people design my operations.
And you know the guy.
Mike, once upon a time, back when I had 3 stripes and driving a submarine was all I had to worry about, Ryan and I helped steal a whole Russian submarine.
Yeah, and if you repeat that to anyone, I'll have one of my Marines shoot your ass.
Sink some of their ships, yeah, splash a few of their airplanes, sure, but trailing our coat in sight of land? Jesus!
It'll shake them up some.
If they don't sink some of my ships in the attempt.
Hey, Tony, the voice on the phone said. It took Brittano a second to recognize it.
Where are you now, Al? The Secretary of Defense asked.
Norfolk, didn't you know? I'm on USS Gettysburg upgrading their SAMs.
It was your idea, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I suppose it was, Tony Brittano agreed, thinking back.
You must have seen this Chinese thing coming a long way off, man.
As a matter of fact, we... The SecDef paused for a second.
What do you mean?
I mean, if the Chi-Coms loft an ICBM at us, this Aegis system does give us something to fall back on. If the computer simulations are right.
They ought to be. I wrote most of the software, Gregory went on.
Secretary Brittano didn't want to admit that he hadn't really thought about that eventuality. Thinking things through was one of the things he was paid for, after all.
How ready are you?
The electronic stuff is okay, but we don't have any SAMs aboard. They're stashed at some depot or something, up on the York River, I think they said. When they load them aboard, I can upgrade the software on the seeker heads. The only missiles aboard, the ones I've been playing with, they're blue ones. Exercise missiles, not shooters, I just found out. You know, the Navy's a little weird. The ship's in a floating dry dock. They're going to lower us back in the water in a few hours.
He couldn't see his former boss's face at the moment. If he could, he would have recognized the, oh shit, expression on his Italian face.
So you're confident in your systems?
A full-up test would be nice, but if we can loft 3 or 4 SAMs at the inbound, yeah, I think it ought to work.
Okay, thanks, Al.
So how's this war going? All I see on TV is how the Air Force is kicking some ass.
They are. The TV's got that right, but the rest can't talk about it over the phone.
Al, let me get back to you, okay?
Yes, sir.
In his office, Brentano switched buttons. Ask Admiral Seaton to come in to see me.
That didn't take very long.
You rang Mr. Secretary? The CNO said when he came in.
Admiral, there's a former employee of mine from TRW in Norfolk right now. I set him up to look at upgrading the Aegis missile system to engage ballistic targets.
I heard a little about that. How's his project going? Dave Seaton asked.
He says he's ready for a full-up test.
But, Admiral, what if the Chinese launch one of their CSS-4s at us?
It wouldn't be good, Seaton replied.
Then how about we take our Aegis ships and put them close to the likely targets?
Well, sir, the system's not certified for ballistic targets yet, and we haven't really run a test, and...
Is it better than nothing? The SecDef asked, cutting him off.
A little, I suppose.
Then let's make that happen, and make it happen right now.
Seaton straightened up.
Aye, aye, sir.
Gettysburg first. Have her load up what missiles she needs, and bring her right here, Brentano ordered.
I'll call Sacklant right now.
It was the strangest damn thing, Gregory thought. This ship, not an especially big ship, smaller than the one he and Candy had taken a cruise on the previous winter, but still an ocean-going ship, was in an elevator. That's what a floating dry dock was. They were flooding it now to make it go down, back into the water to see if the new propeller worked. Sailors who worked on the dry dock were watching from their perches on whatever the hell you call the walls of the damn thing.
Weird, ain't it, sir?
Gregory smelled the smoke. It had to be Senior Chief Leak. He turned. It was.
Never seen this sort of thing before.
Nobody does real often, excepting those guys over there who operate this thing. Did you take the chance to walk under the ship?
Walk under 10,000 tons of metal? Gregory responded.
I don't think so.
You was a soldier, wasn't you?
Told you, didn't I? West Point, jump school, ranger school, back when I was young and foolish.
Well, Doc, it's no big deal.
Kinda interesting to see how she's put together, especially the sonar dome up forward. If I wasn't a radar guy, I probably would have been a sonar guy, except there's nothing for them to do anymore.
Gregory looked down.
Water was creeping across the gray metal floor. Deck, he wondered, of the dry dock.
"Attention on deck!" a voice called.
Sailors turned and saluted, including Chief Leak. It was Captain Bob Blandy, Gettysburg's CO. Gregory had met him only once, and then just to say hello.
"Dr. Gregory?"
"Captain?" They shook hands.
"How's your project been going?"
"Well, the simulations look good. I'd like to try it against a live target."
You got sent to us by the SecDef?
Not exactly, but he called me in from California to look at the technical aspects of the problem. I worked for him when he was head of TRW.
You're an SDI guy, right?
Well, that and SAMS, yes, sir. Other things. I'm one of the world's experts on adaptive optics from my SDI days.
What's that? Captain Blandy asked.
The rubber mirror, we called it. You use computer-controlled actuators to warp the mirror to compensate for atmospheric distortions. The idea was to use that to focus the energy beam from a free electron laser.
But it didn't work out.